Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Up Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right in just the way I did a quick fade. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a returning special guest, Miss Kieran Vandenblink, right?
Hello, hello.
Did I say it right?
You did.
You have a lot of like middle names. That's like, the key.
You know, Nikki, it's Dutch. So in Dutch, it's pronounced Vandenblink.
That's right.
And the Vanden means from thee, and I happen to be of the sand dunes.
Oh, I love that. We must be connected because I know my people are living sand dunes at some place.
So we were meant to be together.
That's right. So you are, I just was thinking about this on the way over here. You're one of the most creative people I know because you've written a children's book. You have written, directed, produced, acted in your own short. What do you not want to do in the entertainment industry? Because you're doing it all.
Mm. Well, there's so much more. You know, there's this great quote by Betty Davis. She says, "The golden apple is never devoured. Its seeds are endless."
I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah. And so I didn't act in my short because it was me at 17. As youthful as I am, Nikki.
You still look 17, so you're good. You could have done it. You could have played yourself.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. But I did. I initially wrote Fingernail Moon as a one-act play.
Oh, cool.
That I directed. And that was like 10 years ago. And then there was this theater company I belonged to called The Road in North Hollywood. And they had a playwrights festival. And I was asked to read some of the plays. And I said to Scott, who was running it a few years ago, I said, "Oh, hey, I actually have one act." And he's like, "Kieran, get it to me." And so I did, and they accepted it. I wasn't able to direct it. It's a sort of a rule they have.
You can't direct your own piece?
Well, only for the reading. It's just a reading
for
a festival.
Okay.
But my friend did a beautiful job with it. My friend Tommy Dunn, shout out. And Hannah Mae Sturgis, who starred in the actual film, was in the reading. And it was really funny and moving. And afterwards, this lovely woman, she couldn't have been a day over 20, never saw her before, never seen her since. She walked up to me because I was introduced as the writer. And she said, "Look, I don't know you." And I know that was only 15 minutes long, but I'm pretty sure it changed my life.
Whoa. That's insane.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And I thought, I think
we were like, "Who are you? Why didn't you like add her on Facebook and like get her information?" Because those kind of people, you got to hold close.
I know. But, you know, sometimes I think that you can hold people close without holding them onto social media.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, I quote her to this day, you know, because she, with my film, Nikki, I really want to touch people.
Right.
I often think, and I know you as a musician must too, you know, what is like the macrocosmic of all of it? And I find myself walking along the streets of Sherman Oaks, where I now live with my dog, and Huckleberry Finn, if you must
know. Oh, that's awesome. Great name. You got great names for dogs.
Thank you. English major, always.
That's awesome.
And I'll just think about, like, what is it that we do? And I think it's really about connecting.
Yes.
And making people feel, like, less alone. And,
absolutely.
You know, inspiring them to laugh or to cry. And I think just kind of remind people that we're all sort of part of the same fabric.
I literally was having this conversation today with a friend of mine who's an engineer, and he was talking about art in general and versus commerce. And I said, you know, there's some things that will pay great and they're amazing, but they don't fulfill the artist. And then there's this other thing that it's like you make something for the love of it. And it may not make the most money or pay you the most, but there's something so fulfilling. And there's this cosmic magic that comes with it. And I was telling him, I said, those gigs or those moments are exactly why I do this. You know, it's like, that's what propels me to keep feeling inspired, keep feeling that I want to be an artist. And I'm sure you feel the same thing, because it's just like, there are easy gigs where you're there, you get paid super well, maybe more than you think you should be making because it's such a short thing. And it's not that great. It's like, okay, cool. That was like, whatever. And then there's this other thing where you're working with people you believe in, you're working with friends, you've either created the piece like you have, and you're seeing the whole thing unfold in slow motion, and it goes by too quickly, and it's the most fulfilling thing you have ever been a part of. And I feel like I call that cosmic money, you know, because it pays you in energy and vibe and beauty and love and all the things that make you want to be an artist.
Yeah. It's funny. I was thinking of like cosmagic. I was kind of putting words together while you were speaking. But you know what's funny, Nikki? Like when I see a movie or I hear a song that really touches me, I think to myself, I bet that was intensely personal.
Oh, yeah.
And invariably it is. Like Almost Famous was Cameron Crowe's childhood.
His autobiography.
And then there was the movie with Ethan Hawke years ago where he and Patricia Arquette were raising a son. What was that called again? Boyhood?
It was Boyhood. Yeah, the one that took 10 years to make.
Thank you. And by the way, that was so personal to Todd.
No, it wasn't Todd. I'm blanking on his name. It'll come to me later. I love him. He did Dazed and Confused.
I know.
So many other things.
He's from Texas, I think.
Yes, you're right.
But anyway, that was intensely personal to him. And even certain songs that will really resonate with loads of people.
Yep.
Often the songwriter, I think, was it Hey Jude, was about John Lennon's mom dying of cancer?
No, it was about John Lennon's son that he abandoned. And Paul McCartney wrote it as a love letter, like, yo, everything's okay. And
about Julian?
Yeah.
But I was thinking of Let It Be, weirdly enough.
That's about his mom. His mom came to him in a dream. Crazy.
Isn't that just so beautiful?
So beautiful.
And I think, but you know, I also think, Nikki, that we do these things that speak to us. And then I think, because you're mentioning money, I think that the money, whether it's actual, and right now I'm actually speaking about actual money, that it comes from the love, but I think the love comes first. I did, when I actually directed Fingernail Moon as a play, I was starring in another play called I Have It from, at that time, an up-and-coming, amazing female playwright named Becca Brunstetter, who's now a producer and writer on This Is Us, I might add.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so she's, but the play that she wrote spoke to me, the sort of like self-possessed young woman whom I played. And she had this quirky, like sharp intelligence that I immediately could relate to. And we did it in a theater that was 35 seat. We added seats and we were like, now it's 43. One of our playwrights came up to me after a couple weekends and said, I love what you're doing. And I said, thank you. And he said, I want to bring my best friend to see you. And I said, oh my God, bring your grandma. I want everyone there. I got to fill the seats.
Right.
Because I was co-producing it. And he looked at me and he said, Kieran. And I said, yeah. And he goes, my best friend is Alec Baldwin. I said, oh no, no, bring him.
That's awesome.
And that led to Alec coming, because we had like a special night that I had to really like urge my producing partner to do, because she was very much like one and done. I was like, no, no, milk.
We need this.
Yeah. And he came and he called Lorne Michaels the next day, and NBC flew me out 8 days later to test for Saturday Night Live.
That's incredible.
It's incredible. I never did stand up a day in my life. I still haven't, FYI. But and I never went to like an improv school. I think Alec was really bright, like he really got
He got it. He sees talent all the time.
Yeah.
So he knows good talent.
Yeah. But it was funny because it started with love and then I was flown out. It was so quick. So I think when you start with the love, the money will come. Sort of like if you build it, they will come.
Well, I mean, the reason I was talking about that, it's like we were talking about, and you'll totally resonate with this. So, you know, I've had songs and TV shows and, you know, some films and stuff. And some of the TV shows that are paid the most, they barely even use the song. It's in the background, and it's this, like, background music, you know? And it's a huge paycheck. It's like, wow, this is I can't believe they even pay for this. Like that. And then there's a friend of mine that's a filmmaker right now, and you'll totally love this. I'm getting chills right now thinking about it. He's directing a movie. It's called Abby's List. It's about his dog that died. And he did a bucket list before she died. of all the things that she would want to maybe do as a dog, like go to the Sequoias, visit like these famous, you know, animal handlers. And I was like, yo, I love my dog. I want to be a part of this, whatever. And he's like, I don't have a budget, you know, that's huge. I said, I don't care. I said, this is more fulfilling for me to just be a part of this. And he ended up using, he's going to use like maybe one, he's definitely using one song and he's already showed it to me. And he may be using a couple more songs. But the cool thing is the focus and showcase of the song is such a beautiful piece to the film. As an artist, I'm like, this is why I make art. Yeah. It's like to collaborate and just to make something that is even bigger than what I could make, you know? Yeah. And it's and it paid maybe one-tenth, or it's going to pay me one-tenth of what the other thing did. But it's giving me so much more fulfillment to see it used in a way that's, you know, resonating with me for the story and the movie. And I watched the whole movie and I was like, this is a great movie. I want to, I'm so happy to be a part of it. But that's what I'm saying. It's like art is like this weird thing that can't be completely, you know, translated in finances. So yes, it is fulfilling when you get a great paycheck because you can make more art. But there's this other thing as an artist, you want the work to be showcased or visualized or created or, you know, just a way to put your story into words or motion. When it's finished, that is the most fulfilling thing.
Yeah.
And you've done it. You've done it. You've done it time and time again. So this story, I know it resonated with you because it had a lot to do with your mom.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
And your mom passed about 8 years ago?
No, when I was 17.
Oh, that's right. You were in high school.
Yeah.
That's crazy. How did you become a great woman like you are without having your biggest woman influence?
Oh, it's like a very, it's a loaded question. I don't know. You know, I think, I definitely feel like there were many moments where I knew that I was like missing something, but it was sort of this, I actually talk about it in my film. The character called Sam, who's based on me, she talks about this feeling like there's like a fuzz in your eye and you know it's there, but you can't get it out. And you know that you're not seeing clearly and you paw at it, but you just can't get it out. And it was, that's kind of like
a great visual.
Yeah. And it's kind of the metaphor that I felt like off and on for years. But, you know, I think one thing that's so beautiful that's happened to me that I feel so grateful for is this feeling, this knowing, like a certainty that she's even here right now with us. But it was certainly not instant at all. And I remember like talking, because my grandparents were missionaries in Indonesia in the 30s and 40s. And my grandmother was a woman of great faith. This is my Dutch side. And
old school. The old schoolers are always like, we are hardcore about religion.
She was amazing. She had this like really sort of very calm and very graceful energy. And she would sit on our front porch in New Jersey. We had this beautiful glassed in porch, and she would say, I'm looking at the fireflies, ping.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And so I remember when I was like, you know, after my mom passed and I was a teenager, and she was asking about my relationship to God, and I was like, oh well, I totally don't believe in him at all.
Wow.
And she said, that's so great. And I said, what? And she said, no, because it's in the question that you get closer. And I was thinking, I'm so not close, totally not close. And I wanted to be a rebel, and it was annoying to me that my rebelliousness was like a part of it.
Right.
Like I wanted to like blow the bubble, you know, and not still be in it. But now I get what she was saying. Like when you fight against something, you're still on the court playing ball.
Right.
And I was certainly like fighting against it. But now, I don't know, over the last however many years, I talk to her. Like, I'll walk my dog and, you know, and I'll just sort of talk to her. And yeah, like, absolutely, sometimes we miss the body. I think when someone passes, we miss the smell and the hug and the body. And that's totally normal and human. But I think sometimes when you take a deep breath and sort of realize that, like, love is so much bigger than death.
Right.
And none of this is to sound corny or preachy.
I love that. Just give me chills. Wow. That's awesome.
But it is. And so, directing and writing the film it just felt really magical.
Now, I remember reading all your posts when you were making the movie, and you had these moments where you felt like your mom was there in these like crazy days of filming. Give me some of those moments, because that's the stuff that I'm like, I love when the human existence kind of crosses over into that other realm that we're not really sure of, but it's there. You know what I mean?
Crossing over with John Edwards.
That's right.
I always say it to my dog. I'm like, look, let's cross over. Not with John Edwards. You know, so basically I was living in Amsterdam for the year because I'm half Dutch and half Lebanese. I was with my sister and her family in Holland, in Amsterdam. And it was so funny. I posted on Facebook, I'm directing my first film. And it was sort of like you say it and then you step into the becoming of it.
Right.
So I just said it. And I had two friends, and I say friends in quotes because I'd never met either of them. They were older guys who had gone to my high school, but like not at the same time as me. And they both reached out. A private message on Facebook and said, how can we help you fund it?
That's awesome.
I know. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. I said, like, I don't have a business account yet. I don't want to like buy a chai tea and be like, oh, shoot, that wasn't my money.
Right.
So I was like, just let's wait. And I quickly called Wells Fargo and set up a business account.
Smart.
And then it was like it all came. Like it's that if you build it, they will come. I went to Barnard College at Columbia, New York. And I posted on Barnard has a Facebook page. And this woman was like, are you looking for a line producer? And I was like, yes, I am.
You're like, it's funny that you asked.
I know. I was like, www.yes.net. So she came on board and it just was like this. There was an ease. That's all I can say, Nikki. There was just an ease. I didn't feel like I was pushing anything. I didn't feel like I was like uncomfortable or like nervous or all the energy.
It's that predestined thing.
Yeah.
It's like you get in line with it. I feel like. The worst things can happen when you're not aligned with that. So when you're aligning with that, that's your dharma, you know? Yeah. So it's like, you're like, oh, this is what I should be doing. So of course it's going to work out, you know?
What's that book again where the guy, it's like a journey, he's having a journey and then he ends
up. Celestine Prophecy?
No, like that. But then there's another one where it's like this young man, like maybe he's in Egypt or something. And then.
Oh, you're talking about.
He takes these different journeys, but like he doesn't know where he's going. There's like jewelry involved or something.
Yeah. You're talking about. Hermann Hesse, and the book is called, my God, I know the guy, I'm thinking of the name.
I think it's Paulo Coelho I'm thinking of.
Oh, you're thinking of The Alchemist.
Yes, oh my God, good job, by the way, I love your, I love that, you were just like,
Yeah, but I'm thinking of the other book that I'm thinking of, I'll come around with that. Siddhartha, thank you, connected the dots, Siddhartha,
book
that's
readers.
Right, that's right.
But in The Alchemist.
Right.
It was like, mine was different because in The Alchemist, he felt kind of stumbling in things and then it was magic. I suppose it was a bit of that, but we all sort of came together. I had Hannah May, who was in the reading. I kept her on. She's super special. And then Tyler Cook came to us through a friend on Facebook. But it was like,
moving
piece by piece.
Yep.
Yeah. And then I was rehearsing my actors over WhatsApp in Europe.
What?
WhatsApp.
What, you just had like a video, like a phone?
No, it wasn't even a video. It was all audio.
What?
Yes. And then I came out to LA because I wrote my children's book, Sniff. And then my friend Chuck is my writing partner. We created an animated series called The Sensational Five. And we were pitching it to studios. So I flew out to pitch and rehearsed with them in front of a church. Because my movie takes place literally in front of the Baptist church in my hometown. And then we flew everyone out to my town. It's called Hightstown, New Jersey. That's a little drop of a town.
Right.
If you sneeze, you're like, we got to turn around. it's really, really charming. And it looks a lot like it did when I was little. It's like the
best
version.
So it's been untouched, basically.
Yeah,
like
you know.
Things here
and I'll
there.
Say, though, Nikki, it's untouched. And yet, and this is going to sound so funny. But like when I was little, I would dream that it was like more amazing. Even though it was really charming, it felt like the little brother of Princeton. And sort of the little brother who was like, what about me? It isn't fair. I've had none. Now I want my share. Can't you see?
Love it.
I want to live. So I felt like I knew it could even be more.
Right.
And when I came back, it was like shining at me like, look, mama. And it was just even shinier and happier and more beautiful. And there's like all of these young families like around my age and younger who have moved in. And they just like they think it's the most delicious place in the world. They've got Instagram and Facebook pages and all kinds of wonderful things. And they love my hometown properly. So we flew out And my prep school, the Petty School, is in my town. And so we slept at the headmaster's old house, which is now like an inn for parents who are visiting their kids. And it's beautiful. Beautiful old house, like very East Coast, you know,
awesome.
Like wooden molding, tall ceilings. It smells fresh,
right?
Big expansive windows. We all stayed there and we shot in front of the Baptist church where I used to go when I was 17, with this man upon whom my mom would be proud of me, upon whom I had a crush. I would obviously never say it like that, but and I think my mom was doing something extraordinarily generous, because I think my mom knew at this point that she was dying, and I think that what she wanted to do was to have me spend time with this guy because his mom had died years before.
Wow.
And she knew that he would know how to sort of guide me. Plus, I had a massive crush. He sort of taught me lifeguarding, and so I already had a major crush on him. And then I got to drive with him in this convertible, you know, among the cornfields of Central Jersey where I grew up, and just ask questions. And so back to that play I was telling you about that Alec came to. My producing partner is this very ambitious young woman who said to me, "Kieran, I want you to write a one act for the festival." And I said, "Wait, what makes you think I can write a one act?"
Right.
And she goes, "Because you can." And I did. And so it was a great reminder to myself to really...
How many rewrites did you do?
None.
What?
No, but the thing of it is, Nikki, is it's a moment.
Right.
So some people might say, "Oh, well, where's the structure?" Or, "Oh, something needs to happen." And I was very clear that...
You knew what it was.
This
you
is
knew
a
your
moment.
Beginning, middle, and your end.
And what I did was I culled moments from my own life. Like, there was a moment in my own life where I was talking to this guy. The character of Ted is based on him. And I was in my house talking to him, and this moment was like crescendoing. And I said to him, "If she dies, I don't know what I'll..." And as I said the D of do, my mom, this is true story, this is happening. My mom comes into the kitchen and I can hear her slippers sliding on the floor. And she goes, "You'll be just fine."
Whoa. Oh my God. I got chills.
So that those are so what I did was I culled moments
right.
to put them into one big moment. And
that's a heavy, heavy thing.
It's a heavy thing, but my film is truly not heavy.
Right.
It's
hopeful.
Well,
it's full of
very.
Hope.
Yeah. I mean, look.
Well, that's how you are, period. I already knew it.
Yes, I'm extraordinarily hopeful. But the truth is I shouldn't take away. Like, I don't like the word heavy because that feels like, oh, but I would be dishonest if I said to you that there wasn't a heaviness, because ultimately losing your mom, especially when you're a teenager, is heartbreaking.
I think losing your parents, it's my biggest fear. So, I mean, I can't imagine you being 17 and losing somebody so close to you mm-hmm. and then putting it into art, like for the whole world to see. That is bravery and vulnerability mm-hmm. and beauty all swirled into one. So first I want to tell you, it's so funny that our interview aligned today, because on the Today Show, you know who Ken Burns is?
Yeah.
So he was on the Today Show this morning, and he is doing this thing about hometowns. Mm-hmm. And he wants everybody to make a short little 15-second little, you know, self movie talking about your hometown. You have to do this.
Oh,
you have to do this.
About Hightstown.
Yes. And there's I'll have to send you the link, but There's a hashtag. It's, I think it's like Honor My Hometown or My Hometown, something like that. And it's just about having this, you know, this place that unites all of us, and all these places are different and they're in different places. But the reverie that everybody has for these hometowns is what shapes us and what helps us grow. And it's like our nest that we always come to and then we leave to go, you know, follow dreams or pursue aspirations or whatever it is. And you made a movie about it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to do this.
I will.
And you have to plug your movie, because it's like a two-in-one, and he's going to love it. So
I will. Thank you. For
yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You. Yeah. I always say it's the town that raised me.
Right. And the title, I remember you telling me this, but I want other people to kind of know about this. The Fingernail Moon was something your mom used to always point out to you.
Yeah.
When you were real little.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So tell me what the significance of the fingernail, what did she used to tell you about the fingernail moon, or why was it such a significant thing for you?
It's a great question, because She used to say that God left his fingernail behind for us.
That's awesome. That's very
but
cool.
I love the moon. When I had been on Broadway in New York in The Diary of Anne Frank.
Wait, hold on real quick. You say that, but let's also just add that Natalie Portman was in the same play with you for this.
Yeah,
right?
I played her sister.
So I love that you're like, oh, wait, when I was on Broadway with Natalie Portman. Okay, go on.
Yeah.
Go on.
No, she became one of my best friends.
That's awesome.
Anyway, so when the show was over, I felt a particular sadness. I think it just was that the end, the show felt like a family.
Right.
And it was a 9-month run. It only went for 8.5 because once Natalie left, it sort of, the sparkle sort of left the show. But it's a really long run for a straight play on Broadway. I didn't know that because it was my first gig as an actor.
Usually they're like 6 months, maybe 3 months.
I really don't even know. Yeah. Probably, you're right. Yeah. I mean, I had never done anything besides a Clean and Clear commercial. So it was all terribly new to me. But it was a really juicy run and we spent holidays together and...
That's awesome.
And it's wonderful as an actor, clearly as a human being, but it's wonderful as an actor to be a part of something. Because I think we all know what it feels like to be sort of like skipping from thing to thing. But I think to be a part of something and to be friends with the crew and the people.
And it grows. It's like a pulsating
it
thing.
It does.
It's like a breathing thing.
It is. And it's really, really, you really can't underestimate how it feels to belong. And so I think when the show ended, it sort of like echoed other losses.
Right.
And I felt this particular sadness. I called it the sadness of 26. anyway, I remember leaving Manhattan on the bus because my dad was still in our hometown with my stepmom. And I was on like a Greyhound bus going back to New Jersey. And I was feeling quite sad. And I remember looking up at the sky and the moon seemed to follow my bus. And as simple as it is, I had this extraordinarily comforting feeling like the moon is following me. It's with me. The moon never leaves me, even if it's cloudy or sunny or if it's raining or if it's super, super, super bright. The moon is always there.
Right.
And then I thought, like, my mom.
That's awesome.
And then I felt like... she was the moon.
Right.
So I began to feel this closeness to the moon. And then so the title worked so well. And then I loved the idea.
Well, it's such a like a playful but deep and like visual title. That's what I love about it.
Yeah.
It's all those things.
Yeah. Yeah. So we shot because it's an 18.5 minute take. It's one take. And
the whole movie is one take?
Yeah. Well, wow. except for we have like a minute and a half in the beginning where they are drone shots, which is really like a Valentine to my hometown because it looks really beautiful.
That's awesome. I saw some of the shots in the trailer. So,
we had these
so
really
awesome.
Funny guys from New York. They were like total millennials. I love them so much. Like they were like playing like Drake and talking about bitcoins and it was hilarious. But they were so talented and I found them on this spot on Facebook called Where's Spot, which is a great place to meet other filmmakers, and that's also where I found my whole post crew as well. They did these beautiful shots, and then once they drive the car up to the church, it's one 18.5 minute take.
Wow.
And my DP,
how many pages?
I'm gonna say
about 30.
No, not as much, because 30 actually is really long, because it's usually like a minute a page.
But all the action is, you know, it goes so fast, so that's why I overestimate.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when you say how many pages, because it wasn't really properly paged like you would do on Final Draft. It was like the Garen Draft.
That's awesome.
So it's, I don't really know, but I mean, the film is 18.5 minute take, so I would say it was probably like, maybe if it were properly done, it would be like 15 pages.
Okay, wow.
But when they drive up to the church and they park, it's one take. Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
And my DP, that was what attracted him to the film, was the idea of him having
shooting one take.
Yeah, because it was a steady cam.
Right.
And
it was just one shot.
Yeah. And we shot it on a red Epic Dragon. Which
That's
is really
amazing.
Beautiful. And at one point, I remember his belt broke one day, and he's like, oh, no, oh, no, because it was so heavy. but it was incredible what he did. Like, the camera really feels like it's really intimate.
Right.
And he's in – you feel like you're watching a conversation, and it almost feels like there's something happening that you're privy to, right, but you don't even necessarily know who they are or what their relationship to one another is, which I love. I sort of love the idea of people figuring it out.
Right.
And I love the idea that what they're talking about is ultimately more important than what their relationship to one another is, that it's sort of bigger than them. And I'm also really fascinated. I got this review from Final Draft, speaking of which, where the woman said something about how you're expecting Sam, who plays me, well, that's the character based on me, that she asks him this question, Ted. It's just, it's a two-hander, so it's just two, right, two characters. And she asks him, what's it like? And she, the reviewer, the critic, said that she thought it was going to go into something kind of sexy.
Right.
And she thought it was really refreshing that it didn't, which the funny thing is, Nikki, I never thought of it being something sexy.
What? Because you lived it.
I lived it.
Yeah, it's a different
thing. And I guess also, I think that sometimes we see in films, like, a guy and a girl are always going to be
right,
dating or wanting to date or hoping they can date or secretly, they, you right, know. And I kind of liked exploring.
You wanted the tension there.
Yeah. I mean, she has a crush. To right, me, that was very clear. But I like the fact that it doesn't have to turn anything
right,
into anything overtly.
Well, and it's like shaping a bigger story.
Way.
That's the what great art does.
I feel like a valley girl. Way. but I loved that kind of like gossamer feel to it.
Right. And did you find there was one take that stood out over others? Did you, like, when did you know, okay, that was the one? Because you had to run it through how many times? Maybe 10, 20?
We did 6 takes.
Wow.
We did at sunrise and sunset.
Wow.
Sunrise.
That's right.
we had a beautiful
sunset. You need to write a musical next.
That's, I know. Darling Nikki. Darling Nikki.
That's right.
Okay, so we did a sunrise. We were there really, really early because it was the summer. And it was this beautiful golden honey dew light. Even at one point, like that very, very, very final take.
Right.
Literally the sun was setting and our colorist did an extraordinary job of lightening it up because it actually got really dark. It was just, he did something totally different. I had always directed him to be really emotive in this one part. And when he got to it, he didn't do it that way. I had right, never seen him do it this way. He fumbled over the line, which was so human because sometimes when you're in a vulnerable moment, you'll be like, and then I was stunned. No, not stunned. I was shocked. You didn't mean to say stunned.
Right.
Or you're like, she died. Like you just, and he did something so beautiful and human like that. And he kept it in. And the funny thing is after we shot it, he said out loud, I don't feel good about that take. I didn't feel really good about that take. And I was like, oh boy, I hope I like that take. We don't have that many to go on.
Right.
And then he and Hannah, they redid the whole movie on a little iPhone in the back of the church because he felt so incomplete about that take. And it was a lesson to me as an actor that mm, it feels really good to emote.
Right.
It feels so good.
But when you don't.
But when you don't, then the audience gets to feel really good. Yeah. And they
well, it's
get to
also
do
the,
it for
the
you.
Restraint. The
yeah,
restraint.
The
I find
beautiful.
That is a lot. That's a more powerful.
It's
thing
so
to
beautiful.
Do.
We actually went to Garden State Film Festival, which was perfect because that's my state.
Right. Absolutely.
And it felt really, really good to be there. And it's in Asbury Park, which is Bruce's place.
That's right. That's right.
So and Thunder Road has a bit of a role in the film as well. So that all felt very magical. And there was another film that we were in the same category with. It was also a short, and the actress was very lovely, and it's not at all a critique on her performance. Excuse me. But I do want to say this, Nikki, that her performance was very emotive.
Right.
And it was lovely. It was lovely. But I said to Hannah, because Tyler and Hannah were both nominated for Best Actor, and I said to Hannah, I actually think it was what you did was more, it was more restrained.
Right.
And it was really beautiful to watch a young woman do her best to keep it together
right,
in front of this handsome man she had a crush on, but also really needed like a shoulder to lean on, but wasn't going to put it all out there to him because,
right,
well, he's not her boyfriend or her best friend. Now, the other film was a completely different story, but I actually felt what she did was so human.
Right.
Because think about it, like, in life, it's rare that you sit with someone and just let it all out. Most of the time, you can feel your lip quivering and you're like, oh.
Right.
You're like looking
together.
Away.
Keep it together.
Yeah. And it's very human
right,
to feel like, I had a talk with a naturopath I hired on Zoom last week, and I started crying about Gatsby, my dog who passed away, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I hadn't cried.
Right.
I love him and I feel close to him. It had been like months and I didn't expect it. And I found myself apologizing. And she was like, no, it's so good for you to get it out. But that's what I mean. Like, right. We actually don't want to do that, really.
But that's where the power is, too. It's like.
And then the audience does it for you.
Right.
And then that feels really good for them.
Well, it's a dialogue.
That's it.
So it's like audience and whatever's playing.
Yeah.
And it's also like. I find this with music. It's like if I'm doing a guitar solo, I will always do like two or three takes where I'm like, let me just get all the noodling licks out and then let me play something really musical. And the thing that makes the record, it's like not what I played, it's what I didn't play that makes the record, you know? So it's the same thing with acting or just emoting with art. It's like, it's not just like, oh, being overly dramatic. It's about reining it in and about it's the things that you don't put out there. That you're right. The audience feels that connection and they respond because they're waiting for that, you know?
They're totally. Actually, and there was a classical musician. I don't know if it was Mozart or if it was Beethoven, but he said something about how the music was actually between the notes.
Debussy.
Thank you. I love Debussy.
Yeah, that's what
he said. Oh my gosh, high five.
Music is the space between the notes.
I cannot believe you.
And I know my stuff.
I love him. I love
he's
Debussy.
He's the best.
I love Debussy.
And you know what? He is in the Romantic period, and everything about the Romantic period with poets, painters, Monet, all these people. Paul Verlaine was one of the famous French poets.
Oh, French.
Everything was all about, let's make it the most passionate. Let's make it the most romantic. Let's make it all about love. Let's have our hearts bleeding on our sleeves. So everything was lush. And I find that's my favorite part of art and music. Because they all were like making things together. They were all bouncing ideas. They were all friends. So they were, see this renaissance of beauty and art in a way that, it's not really defined by art periods like that now, but I mean, it's happening. You see it. You're doing it, you know? So when you were finished with the movie, did you look back and think of all the obstacles or did you think of all the triumphs? What was the moment that you were like, oh my God, it's finished and this is what I'm thinking about that we went through?
Really, it wasn't obstacle-y at all. It had such ease.
That's amazing.
I think I just felt really grateful.
You were like, I wanted to do this. I set out to do it. It got done. The right people came into motion. It's finished. Did you have a moment like talking to your mom when you knew it was finished? Or when it's like, it's kind of nerve-wracking making a piece of art. And then you know when it's finished. You know when it's done. And the font is done. Everything, all the packaging, whatever it is. When it's finished, you know your mom must have been overjoyed. What was that connection or what was that experience?
Well, there are two things. I actually want to go back 1 second because it wasn't obstacle-y, except there is an exception that I do want to vociferate, if I may.
Nice, good work.
Thank you, thank you. So we had raised the money and it was really flowing in at a good clip. And we also had an executive producer. One of those two guys who reached out to me ended up being our executive producer, Stephen Van Praagh, who's an extraordinarily generous human being. But we hadn't raised enough for post. And so that was the obstacle, Nikki, was that we had an extraordinary post crew that came in and they worked for free. That was really the understanding. But that was the obstacle, was that, you know, I think when you make a film and it's done, people are like, wait, why do you need money again? You did it. And
no, it's not finished.
I know. And that's a little bit harder to understand. And also if it's like after the fact, it's sort of like, well, wait a second.
Well, everybody thinks of the filming. They don't think of all the other work.
And that's my job as the director and the producer. And that was a learning curve for me because I like everyone to get paid. And I also... That also enables you to go to more festivals.
Right.
So that was like the missing piece was post, because that would enable so much, like the Bruce music. Like there are all these different things. The reason, Nikki, that you haven't seen it streaming or at bigger festivals is because I'm still working my way through you know, getting the rights for the music.
Right.
And that's really post. So that was the learning curve for me, was that you when you're planning it out, that you make sure that you either, you know, secure grants or funding, or that you make really conscientious efforts with specific people or organizations for post. Because I do think it's fair that everyone is paid, even if you express that to them before. I just think that's fair. And I also think it just gives you more freedom to submit to festivals and to fly to festivals and to secure the money. So that would be, I would say, the obstacle. It had nothing to do with the actual creative aspect of it. That's the other aspect of me is the one that I'm growing. And in terms of my mom, there was a moment where, so I wanted to shoot in my hometown because I felt like it would be magical. I felt like if the crew and the actors were there,
they'd feel everything.
And they did. They all did. Everyone did. Like the my DP was like, I'm going to go to Orange Theory. And I'm like, wait, there's an Orange Theory in my town? Are you sure? How are you getting there?
Right.
I've never even heard of a gym in my town other than like the gymnasium in the school. Right. So, I mean, but they felt it. You know, and we got all of these local restaurants to give us food, and it was just delicious and kind. And a newer couple of friends of mine, they had a barbecue for us. And another friend, a couple of our interns who all went to my college, all of the interns stayed at her house, and she cooked delicious breakfasts and things for them. So it takes a village,
right?
And that was my village. But one of the reasons I also wanted to do it in my town was because I wanted to capture the East Coast summer.
Right.
There's a smell in the air, and there's a thickness of the trees, and
there's the heat. Let's talk about the heat.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't so bad, but there is indeed
there's
heat.
A humidity. But there's a vibe that comes with it.
There's a vibe, and it's East Coast, and it's for me, like I get off of a plane or like out of a car, and I'm like, oh, I'm home.
Right.
And so I also wanted the fireflies because when I was little, I loved fireflies. And you don't get them in California.
Right.
I think maybe they respond to the humidity. Anyway, so we're shooting the one that we chose, which was the very final take, which was sunset. And this one moment where Hannah playing Sam says something like, how will I... But, like, where do they go? Like, when they die, where do they go? And then Ted says something like, I don't know. And literally, as he says that, a firefly lands on him.
What?
Real firefly lands on him.
That's crazy.
And it's insane. And it was right at that moment. And then there was, like, another moment where, like, they look up at the moon and the streetlights popped on. And it was just at that timing.
That's crazy.
So there were like a few things like that that you felt like, wow, there's just magic in this timing.
That's what I love about film is it captures those moments. Have you seen the movie Garden State?
Yeah, of course.
So do you know the ending of the movie?
Remind me.
So the ending of the movie, they're kissing. And there's a janitor that hits a button. And it closes these two doors. And there's a light that is basically kind of like glowing. And the light starts to close with the doors. None of that was intentional. Wow. It just happened to happen. They didn't even know he was on his shift. He didn't even know there was a filming.
Wow.
Nothing. So when you see that shot, and when Zach Braff said that in the commentary afterwards, I was like, I thought that was so intentional because that was what made the ending of the movie so beautiful. I'm getting chills thinking about it. And it was just one of those moments. Yeah. So it's like you had these moments happening and you captured it. And it's like, aren't you glad there was enough tape and the camera was on and it was charged? Like, those are the things, you know, it's like all the things ready for those moments. So it's amazing. What did you find that was a little bit of kind of too close to home? You have to have a too close to home moment. You're in your hometown. You're making a movie about your mom. You had to have been emotional on some level. Or did you just... Were you just elated because they were all experiencing, all of your players were experiencing the movie in your mind and it was being played out?
Yeah, I think it was the second thing that you said. Okay. But I will admit, and this might sound really silly, but I would watch it like all the time. I was living on the East Coast because I was in post at like a few months after we shot it. And I was staying with some friends And we were in Vermont at one point, like on a vacation, and then we were at their house. And I literally, like, it was my own little secret. Like, I would sneak into my bed at night,
right,
pull out my laptop and watch
and
it.
Watch it.
And I would often cry.
Right.
See,
that's the moment I'm looking for, because yeah, I know it's there.
But what's interesting is that I wasn't crying because, oh my gosh, that was me, how sad. It was bigger than me.
Right.
And I think in order for something to become really special, it has to become bigger than you. And I was watching a story and it felt universal. It felt so beautiful. And I was watching Hannah grapple with these questions, and you could see, one of my favorite things with actors is like when we feel so much emotion that we like lose control of our chins.
Right.
It's subtle, but you can see it and you really can't fake it.
You can't fake that.
And when you see it, it just breaks your heart. And you, and I remember like watching Henry Thomas's audition for E.T. when he was a little boy.
I watch that all the time. Yeah. I watch that YouTube video all the time
because
it's so intense.
It's so intense, but you see his little chin goes.
Right.
And
they're like, you got a kid.
He goes, you got a kid. Exactly. Oh my gosh. So our third high five, everyone.
That's
right. Maybe even our fourth. But that Hannah has that because she's like, you know, her mouth is like slanting downwards and her little chin, and she's doing her best to keep it together. And it just breaks your heart. And then Tyler has a beautiful moment in the end where he's talking about his own mom, and it equally breaks your heart. And that was the part that he thought wasn't good.
Right.
And it was such a lesson to me about the power of restraint. So I think it became so much bigger than me.
Right.
That I didn't feel like I was ever crying for me.
That's beautiful. I love it. You wrote it. You produced it. You produced it. You wrote it. You produced it. You directed it.
Mm-hmm.
What was your favorite one hat that you were wearing? You were wearing three hats.
Mm. Well, when I had written it, it was just easy, and from what I recall, it just had to flow. I don't remember like struggling over it. And I love directing it. The thing that's interesting though is that we did it in one take.
Right.
So my experience of directing my first film was unique.
That's ambitious too, to do it all in one take.
It's all I ever saw because it's a moment.
Right.
And I come from theater.
Right.
And theater, you're in the moment.
Well, you made it like a stage. It was a stage play, but you brought that stage play vibe to it.
Yeah. And thank God for my DP, because my idea, which is unfathomable now in afterthought, but was that they were just going to sit on the lawn in front of the church and we were just going to film them sitting. And he was like, he's like, Kieran, I think that might be boring. And I was like, I don't know. Let's see. And so we filmed it and I was like, oh. And then he had all these tremendous ideas. And it was interesting how the smallest shift was intensely important.
Right.
Like she stands up and I'm like, oh, I love when she stands
right
up. And he's like, let's have them getting out of the car and they're going to walk in front of the church because it's a really old Baptist church. And there's like a stone wall in front of it. And then it has these stones that are like grooving up, you know, like sort of like ocean waves.
Right.
And it's a really beautiful sort of contour behind them. So they walk in front of the church and then they walk up the steps, and she has a little bit of a thing she does on the steps, and then they walk onto the lawn. And my nephew had this brilliant understanding of it. He's like, I love what he said. I was so proud of him. He was like, well, it starts out in the car and it's all, it's like this red car and it's like youth and they're outside and it's fun and it's fresh. And he's like, and then he's like, they get on the lawn and it's green and it's coming of age and it's,
oh,
it's youth and they're young and they're working their way through stuff. And then they get to the front door of the church and it's like the heart and it's the heartbeat. And actually, I think initially I was trying to get a yellow car because I think he was like, it's the yellow of the sun and then it's
right,
the green of the grass and then it's the red heart because the front doors of the church are red. And that's totally the vibe of the film. It's like starts out really fun. And there, you can't like hear what they're saying, but they're talking, and this beautiful song was written for the film, and the song is really lovely and fun and upbeat.
Right.
And then it's the green, youthful, dewy. Because I had three films in mind. I had Rope, Alfred Hitchcock because it's a lot of takes. It's made, not a lot of takes. It's a lot of one takes.
Right.
So I think there are like four actual takes in the whole film. So it was based on Rope. It was based on Stand By Me.
I love that movie. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
When, about like stealing the lunch money, yeah, or something.
Stephen King wrote it.
That's right. That's right. Where they're sitting together, yep, outside. I think they shot that in like Indiana or something. Right. But it's like this beautiful, dewy, juicy moment outside. Those were the films, were Stand By Me and Rope.
And I don't know Rope.
Yeah, Rope is a beautiful Hitchcock where a lot of it, I thought it was one take, and apparently it's more than one, but it's very, very, very few. And the camera just, Hitchcock was famous for figuring everything out way before, right, he even shot. Like he had almost like when people shoot commercials,
right,
storyboard. He storyboarded everything. So he knew exactly how the camera was going to go. And the camera really just stays on this one apartment where the scene takes place. And that was, that and Stand By Me were huge influences for the way I wanted it to shoot my film.
Well, those aren't bad influences. Thank, yeah, God you had good, good influences. Cause, yeah, that, I think good influences influence great art. So, yeah, an amazing movie. Where can people find it? Where can people find you if they, yeah, want to find you online? And I have one last question. So I'm going to let you tell them where, okay, can people find you in the movie?
Okay. So you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at, my handle is at Keef Peef. It's K-I-E-F-P-I-E-F, which was the nickname my high school boyfriend gave me. Little did he know it was going to travel oh so far.
Forever.
He used to make mixtapes for me, which is funny because I wrote this in a festival called Mixtape, and he called it Peef's Pieces. So I was like,
that's awesome. Yeah, it was, I love
it. Super cute. So my Insta and my Twitter are Keef Peef. And then my Facebook is just my name, Kieran Vandenblink. And the film actually has a Facebook page. And I'm actually speaking with Bruce's people, she says.
Awesome.
About just really kind of securing and finalizing the rights, the music rights, because we have a cover of his song. And also one of my actors sort of says a line from Thunder Road. And I really was so sort of innocent about filmmaking that it didn't even occur to me that I would have to do that. But obviously I do. So that's just taking a little while. I would say, you know, by Christmas it will be available streaming. So just hold tight. But I can definitely share the trailer on social media so people can get a taste of
Please
it.
Do. Please do. We're so excited to see this movie. Yay. My last question is a random question. What was your Saturday Night Live audition like?
Oh, boy. So my Saturday Night Live audition, it was so fast.
Right.
Because the play ended on a Tuesday, or we had this, like, special night. So Alec and some other luminaries, Natalie was one of them, could come and watch us on stage. And Alec asked to talk to me. And I remember he had this, like, satchel, and he seemed very professorial at the time. And my best friend from childhood was there, and she, like, flew out of the theater and was like, Alec Baldwin! Like, she couldn't even believe what she was saying. And I was like, and I walked inside, and there he was. And he was like, hi, I'm Alec Baldwin. And I said, hi, I'm Kieran Vandenblink. And, you know, he's like, I love your work. And I said, oh my gosh, we're just so excited you're here. He said, would you ever do Saturday Night Live? And I said, oh my God, I just want to work. And he said, where are you from? And I said, New Jersey. And he's from, you know, Long Island. And it really began a friendship. Our playwright, who is his friend, is this lovely man named Ron Dobson, very talented writer. And I emailed Ron the next day after meeting Alec, and I said, Ron, would it be possible to email Alec Baldwin, because he said I should be on Saturday Night Live? And then Ron wrote back, Alec doesn't say that. And I wrote back, well, but he did. So even if it just goes through you, you know, I don't want you to feel
right
strange. Could I possibly do that? And he was like, yeah, because he doesn't do that. And I said, okay. So then I did, and I called myself like the girl on the bench because I was on the bench the whole time. And Alec went ahead and called Lorne Michaels for me. And I know Alec is going through a hard time right now, but he's only ever been generous and lovely with me and only ever kept his word. Every time he ever made a promise to me, he did it.
That's awesome.
And I'm very grateful for his friendship, his generosity of spirit. He never made me uncomfortable or did anything like walked over any line. He was always someone who believed in me.
That's awesome.
I just want to make that clear.
Yeah.
Because it's a really hard time for him right now. And I'm sending him lots of love for a lot of people right now.
Right.
I'm sending love to everyone involved. But anyway, so so it was really, really quick. So Alec called Lorne Michaels. I was tutoring at the time this little hipster in Brentwood, this really cute kid named Nick. And he would always, like, flop his hair back and talk about Vampire Weekend. Because I'd be like, I know Maroon 5. And he'd be like, well, Kieran, I like Vampire Weekend. I was like, sorry. And I was tutoring this kid, Nick. And my phone blew up, and it was like one of those numbers that can change your life, like a 212-848-8000. Right. And I was like, hello? And she was like, hi, this is Lindsay Shookus from Saturday Night Live.
Wow.
And I'm tutoring a kid in Brentwood. And I was like, yes. And she said, Alec Baldwin called us. And I said, yes. And she said, do you have something you can send us? And I was like, oh, my God. And I had, there was a really beautiful actor who passed away a few years ago named Nelson Ellis. He was on True Blood. And in fact, he was so special that Alan Ball said, I've directed every actor on True Blood except Nelson because I don't know what he's doing. It's so beautiful. I don't want to touch it.
Wow.
And Nelson had cast me in an HBO pilot presentation. So I sent that. It's really funny. It's called Group Therapy. It's on my YouTube page, and it's just really, really funny. And it was all improv. The entire – well, they gave me one line, frankly, but everything else was improvised. And they gave me, like, an idea of where to go. I know you asked one question and tried to get to it.
No, I love this. This is a great story.
So I sent them that, and then I'm tutoring this kid, Nicholas, the next day, and Lindsay calls again and says, we want to see more. Do you have impersonations? And I was like, yes, I do. And no, I didn't. I didn't. I absolutely didn't. Because I had never done improv, like, in any sort of professional or even, like, school sense. Like,
right.
I always was the kid being like, wouldn't this be a funny SNL? I just didn't think I'd be on it doing it. I just had ideas. I think everyone in every corner of, you know, probably America, maybe beyond, is like, wouldn't this be a funny Saturday Night Live?
Right.
Like, you don't think you're going to be doing it unless that's the career you pursue. But I had been on Broadway in Anne Frank, like, notoriously not funny.
Right.
So, I mean, I love making people laugh, but so I had to put things together. So I said to Nicholas, like, what ideas do you have? And I decided to do Harry Potter as 50 Cent. And so I borrowed Nicholas had like his like school jacket, like his prep school jacket. So I was Harry Potter and I bought a wig and glasses and I did my accent. You know, I was like, oh, I'm so sick of Dumbledore. I just did this whole thing and I was like, bitches. And then I did this like really dirty rap as 50 Cent. And then I did a bedazzler. She was like, why do butts suddenly appear every time Aunt Dora's near? So I did this whole thing. I had really long nails. And then I did I do a new age therapist? I think based on that group therapy role. Oh, and I did Miley Cyrus on the cover of Vanity Fair pregnant.
That's awesome.
So I was like, Daddy, you're so silly, Daddy. And I did this. It was really long, too, because I didn't know, like, how long these things were. But the Miley thing, she was like, I'm on MileyIsTheBomb.com. Because I think she actually said TheBomb.com. I did a little research on her. So I did Miley, and I did Harry Potter's 50 Cent, and I did The Bedazzler, and I think I did, like, a group therapist. I think I did, like, three or four.
Amazing.
And I put them all together in, like, the loins of Woodland Hills with my friend's now ex-husband. And my voice was super, super hoarse by the time I got to, like, Aunt Ida's here.
Right.
Just like you. But it worked because it's the crackle. We sent it off. And then that was on a Tuesday night. And it was going really quick. And there I was again with Nicholas in Brentwood. And it was about like 4 o'clock on the following day on Wednesday. And it's the number again. And I'm once again.
You're like, oh my God, I know
hello?
This.
Hello. And hello, Kieran. This is Lindsay Shookus from Saturday Night Live. Hello, Lindsay. Kieran, we want to put you on a flight tonight. You are testing tomorrow.
Oh my God. And you're like, okay, I'll be there.
Legit. And so then I had to cancel my plans. And I forget who even flew me to the airport. Drove me to the airport. And the funny thing is, it was such a whirlwind. I literally have no idea what hotel I stayed in.
Wow.
And I remember being in the hotel and crying because it was just so quick. And also thinking, because I think you have like 3 minutes and you have to, and I had just written these things. So, you know, a lot of people, they work on these bits for years or even months.
Right.
And when you get to SNL, when you get to NBC, to where it is, to Rockefeller Center, it feels like you feel like you're in some big school. There's like all these like backdoor wells and things, and it feels like a big public school. And I remember being in the waiting room, and everyone had these like long pages full of their bits, and they're like memorizing it, looking at the ceiling and going over their lines. And I was like, zoinks. And I...
Zoinks!
Zoinks! Scully! Jinkies. So I just, you know, did my best. And the funny thing is that it almost felt like vaudeville, because you're like, hi, my name is Kieran Vandenblink, and this is the Bedazzler. And then you do it, and then, you know, and this is Miley Cyrus. And then I got to Harry Potter, and I couldn't find Harry's glasses, which clearly are a linchpin of his character.
Right.
So I'm like looking through like a squirrel looking for a nut through my little bag of props. And Chris, as I recall, was their DP. And he was like, Kieran, are you okay? And I was like, I can't find Harry's glasses, Chris. And he's like, do you want to use mine? And I was like, okay. And it was like looking through potato chips. Like, ironically, homeboy's blind as a bat.
Wow.
So I put on these glasses. And I had always heard they don't laugh. They don't laugh. Don't expect them to laugh. Like, you could hear a squirrel in Central Park.
Right.
Because they're like the 12 angry men. And not because they're angry, but because they want you to know that, like, we're not going to coddle you. You have to know what it feels like to be in front of a live audience. They might not laugh. And so they don't laugh. And it's weird, because usually when you're being funny, your friend will even just be like,
right.
You know, just to be kind.
And they're like,
awkward.
I'm not going to do that. Right.
They don't laugh. But then when I was Harry Potter... And the rap is really dirty. But I think also they were laughing because I was like wearing Chris's glasses.
Right.
And so that was really fun. And it felt really exhilarating. And what I remember most about it was like I felt really like I had this relaxed feeling up there. And I think it was because what I call being in such good shape. Because I had been directing, writing, producing, and acting in that one act festival. And I was like well honed. And I had been in front of Alec and Natalie and a couple of my other friends. I'd been studying Kabbalah at their house. So I had like, and people's aunts and uncles and neighbors and grandmother and, you know. And so I felt like what I call being in really good shape. So it felt really, really good. And I'll tell you really quick one more thing. This, because you're not going to believe this. You're literally going to like pop off the chair. So it comes down to like, from what I understand, I was one of their finalists.
Right.
Around that time, I had been through a breakup. And I was really drawn to Echo Park because he had lived in that area. And I think I was still sort of like sniffing out those things. So the only ever time, actually, besides the house that I have now, that I've looked actively like online for housing was then. I went on Craigslist and I was looking at guest houses. And I ended up in this guest house in Echo Park. And you're probably thinking, where does this land? Little do you know. So it was like the second story, this guest house. The name of the person was Mickey. So I thought it was going to be just this dude named Mickey. And I go to the house and this woman answers at the door. And she looks kind of like an attractive sort of producer type. She was very kind and she let me in. And there was this young couple from Brooklyn that was also like casing the joint. We were all, you know, looking around. And the young woman of the couple said, why are you leaving? This place is amazing. And she said, I got a job in New York. And she goes, the woman said, where? And she said, Rockefeller Center. So they left. And I said to her, did you get a job at Saturday Night Live? Because I tested there in the weirdest way. She said, I did. And I said, and she goes, wait a second. Did Alec Baldwin make a phone call for you?
What?
And I said, how do you know that? And then, like in a movie, when you have one of those old beautiful cameras and you adjust the lens,
right.
She went from fuzzy to crisp. She got the role instead of me. It was Michaela Watkins.
Wow.
I was in her damn house.
That's so crazy.
What? And so she was the loveliest person on the planet, but she said that Alec had like gone to her dressing room and been like, how did you get this part in that, Kieran? And so it was weird. Like I had been through a breakup. I had tested for SNL. She had been engaged and booked the part. And I said to her, Michaela, I feel like you're living my life a few years before me. And she looked at me and said, no, I'm just here to show you that you're on the right path.
That's awesome. Oh, you gave me chills.
La la.
Kieran, you are a wonderful talent, a wonderful soul, and you're going to have to come back.
Clearly.
Because you are always going to be creating things and I'm like, what is she doing next? So thank you for creating like you do. Thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Kieran, we'll see you guys here next week.
Au revoir, les enfants.
listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.